Florida's special legislative session begins tomorrow with the future of Visit Florida up in the air. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app or listen anytime. You can also stream us live right now on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. And just ahead, the debate is about to start up again in Tallahassee. How much should we spend to promote tourism in Florida? Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, it's a rising technology, but how to regulate the future use of drones. Plus, it's our new movable feast dining segment as we visit the Rain Tree in St. Augustine. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, a special session gets underway this week in Tallahassee. And one of the big issues lawmakers will try to resolve is the fight over tourism marketing in the state. Now, during the regular session, the state's tourism agency, Visit Florida, saw its budget cut by 67%. What's the future of all this, and what are tourism marketers saying to legislators? We're speaking with one now. He's Robert Scrobe, the executive director of the Florida Association of Destination Marketing Organizations, and he's on the line. Mr. Scrobe, thanks for being with us.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. And Melissa, I want to commend you for having these types of discussions in a world of partisan debates. It's great to be able to actually hear the issue.
We're happy to do it. And what are your questions for Robert Scrobe? And what are your thoughts about how the state should pay or not for tourism marketing? Florida tourism has long been seen as one of the pillars of the state's economy. What do you think about this? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. And so during the regular session, Robert Scrobe, Visit Florida saw its funding reduced by nearly 70%. As lawmakers go back to Tallahassee this week for a special session, they'll be looking at the state's tourism marketing budget. It was gutted in the original budget from its current level of $76 million. What does your organization want to see come out of this special session?
Yeah, I think it's important for the 1.4 million Floridians that rely on the tourism industry for their employment to see our tourism marketing efforts fully funded so that we can attract visitors in a competitive environment. There are some destinations in Florida that, you know, are on a bucket list that people want to go to sometime in their life that they commit to. And there are a lot of others that are beautiful, fabulous places that unfortunately won't attract visitors unless we're able to get the word out and market them to our customers. It's a competitive environment, and we've got to get that message heard to attract visitors to each of our communities.
In fact, Visit Florida said Monday it's even going to be using donated billboards to urge people driving by on highways to call their representatives in Tallahassee and ask for more money to promote Florida as an international vacation destination, sort of guerrilla warfare going on over this funding battle. This has been fascinating to watch as Governor Rick Scott really championed funding for Visit Florida. However, top leadership in Tallahassee disagreed with him. What are your thoughts about this rift when it comes to the Republican leadership over how to fund this and how people in your space, the tourism space, are trying to get their message out in other ways?
Yeah, you know, Governor Rick Scott has been tremendously supportive of anything in our state that will generate jobs and put Floridians to work. And as a Floridian, it's really, we get how beautiful Florida is, and we also see visitors here all the time. And so it's hard to realize that, you know, when we're competing to try to bring visitors from Germany to Florida, and Germans are the visitors that spend more than any other visitors that we attract to our state. But Germans, they have the opportunity to go to the beaches of Spain or Turkey or even, you know, United Arab Emirates, all of which are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to bring those visitors from Germany or the UK or France to their destination. instead of Florida. And so Rick Scott, his leadership has really understood the competitive marketplace that we're in and has been dedicated to making sure that Visit Florida is fully funded.
We'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937 as we speak with Robert Scrobe, Executive Director of the Florida Association of Destination Marketing Organizations. What would you say to those who disagree, who just don't think that taxpayer money should go toward these types of incentives? They don't see the return on investment.
Visit Florida's marketing programs generate over $3 in sales tax for every dollar invested in marketing. And the money that, I think that's a fabulous return on investment for the state of Florida for what it's getting. And the sales tax that's generated helps pay for roads, for schools, for infrastructure, and contributes back. Plus, it generates the direct employment of 1.4 million Floridians. So it's, Florida has been a tremendous partner in helping our tourism industry compete. The other states around the country are aggressive. California still spends more money. Even after this special session, California will be still spending a lot more money than Florida is in attracting visitors. But this is a tremendous step in allowing Florida to at least compete or keep up without losing pace.
Now, as the session gets underway tomorrow, the governor has asked for $76 million for Visit Florida. He originally wanted $100 million. The legislature only wants to allot $25 million. What about your organization, the Florida Association of Destination Marketing Organizations? How does this all trickle down to other groups around the state, like Visit Jacksonville, for example, and your group and others?
Yeah, I think that, there's an effort at the state to focus on the statewide Florida brand. And then within each destination, for instance, Visit Jacksonville also has an organization that's focused on bringing, the visitors that are interested in that Florida brand to bring them to the state or bring them to their community. And that partnership is actually unique in the country. Very few, really there are no other states that have the level of partnership between private business, the local DMO, and the state DMO, Destination Marketing Organization, so the county and the state. And this is why Visit Florida for the last 3 years has been recognized as the best destination marketing organization in the world, because of the level of partnership. Looking at the size of our tourism industry, the size of our budget compared to even cities like Las Vegas, states like California, cities like New York, $150 million would probably put us where we really need to be in order to compete in that tourism marketplace. $100 million is a great start, and 76, we can work with that. That's where we were last year, and certainly gives us resources to be able to keep Floridians employed.
We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. A special session will get underway tomorrow in Tallahassee. And they'll be looking at a number of issues over how we fund not just tourism, but education and other matters. So you disagree with the whole narrative from some leadership in the House, then, that this is all taxpayer-financed corporate welfare, in the name of jobs. What about the agreement that's being reported between House Speaker Richard Corcoran and the governor, a new $85 million economic development fund that the governor would implement and control? How do you see that affecting tourism?
I think anything that does create jobs, helps diversify the economy, brings more employers, and it helps our state economy grow, is going to increase the tax base. It's going to create more, put people to work that are, paying taxes, that are, buying homes or renting homes and buying groceries at grocery stores. And, you know, all of that helps the entire economy grow. And, you know, and having a dedicated source where we can target the employers that are most likely to relocate or bring jobs to Florida, I think helps current businesses that are already here because it brings them customers, and it helps, you know, Floridians as, you know, our state grows and our population grows. I think it's a win, you know, it's a win for everybody.
All right, let's go to your calls, 549-2937. What do you think about the battle over how Florida funds its tourism marketing? Tim, or rather, let's begin with Jason in St. Augustine. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering if there's a sense where there's, is there ever too much tourism? I live in St. Augustine, and it seems clogged beyond its infrastructure with tourists. And I'm wondering what your guest would say about that.
Okay. How much is too much? Robert Scrobe, you're a destination marketer, so I'm guessing you'll say there's never too much. But what about his question?
You know, I think it is something that we have, in particular, as the budget for Visit Florida has grown, something that we've been able to do is focus on off-season. And a lot of parts in our state, there is a tremendous drop in employment and the number of visitors in off-season time. And what we've been focused on over the last couple of years, and there's heat maps where you can see the number of visitors and, you know, the what we call the occupancy rate. It's the rate at which hotels are full, and deploy marketing resources into those areas where there's lower visitors, and so that we can keep year-round employment and, you know, kind of take care of the valleys as well as, you know, attract more visitors so that there are, you know, fewer peaks and fewer valleys overall. So that is, you know, absolutely something that we're concerned about, and something that as we are doing more tourism marketing, we feel that we can actually help resolve going forward.
549-2937. Tim is in Arlington. Hey, Tim, good morning to you.
Good morning. My idea is something that I remember from living in Colorado, where we had a $2 per night tax on hotel rooms. And the local government paid for their advertising that way.
Thanks, Tim. Robert.
Yeah, I think, that was actually instituted after Colorado eliminated their tourism marketing efforts. They figured that, you know, they were the number one brand in winter ski season, and that people would come to Colorado whether they promoted Colorado or not. They actually, within 3 years, became the number three destination for skiing and lost more than $10 billion over 10 years in economic impact. So as having a dedicated funding source for statewide tourism marketing, we fully support that. I think that there'd be some concern over, already there is a local tourist development tax that funds your local DMO. So, you know, imposing more taxes on the guests at hotels would be concerning. But yes, absolutely. I think that having a dedicated funding source for our state's tourism marketing efforts would be a fabulous idea.
And you said Colorado thought, oh, people will come here no matter what. They learned that wasn't the case. Do you think there might be a sentiment among some leadership in Florida that we're so well known as a vacation destination that people will come here whether we promote the state or not?
You know, as a Floridian, you just walk out and see the ocean. It's hard not to fall in love with where we live. And it's hard to imagine that anyone wouldn't want to come here. And in fact, the visitors outside our state haven't experienced that feeling of standing on the beach, seeing that ocean, and what that does to your soul and your energy. And what, you know, if they're in Chicago or they're in New York, they might think that the beach in Mexico or the beach in the Bahamas or now even the beach in Cuba would be just as good as a beach in Florida. And in fact, once they got to Mexico, they'd find that, you know, everything they around is actually cheaper. So it's crucial that as a Floridian, that we take that message and help them realize that they're going to get the best experience possible here in Florida. And that there's no reason that we got to stop visitors from flying over Florida, getting to land here and enjoy the vacation so that we can put Floridians to work.
And we'll go to a few more of your calls in a moment on the fight over funding for Visit Florida at 549-2937. Lots of emails and tweets. Here's one from Rachel. How many employees have jumped ship ahead of these anticipated cuts?
I'm on the board of directors for Visit Florida. As a board member, I know of nobody at Visit Florida who's left because of these concerns over funding. Certainly, you know, the team has seen the industry rally around the organization. And I got to tell you, at Visit Florida, we got a crackerjack team that are doing things with Facebook that nobody in the world is, that we're able to target visitors in our key target markets, get our message to them, and get them to actually book. And what they know about how to market on Google and Facebook and using Instagram is absolutely a trade secret and something worth preserving here in our state. But I don't know of anybody who's left since these budget negotiations have started. And thank goodness, because we got a great team there for the Florida.
Okay, and you talked about the ROI a minute ago, Robert, the return on investment. Here's a tweet from Adam. Does $1 of tourism marketing create more than $1 for the Florida economy? If so, we shouldn't cut this budget. If not, then the cuts make sense. But how do you measure it? How is this measured?
Thank you so much for that tweet, because I couldn't agree more. Florida welcomed 112.3 million visitors who come from, they spent $108.8 billion here in our state. So $108 billion of revenue for hotels, restaurants, gift shops, travel guides, folks that rent chairs on the beach, hot dog vendors, gas stations, convenience stores, $108 billion were spent by people who don't live here. And to put, $76 million, and that's more money than I've ever seen in my life, more money, I have no idea even what that would look like. And so it sounds like a big number, but compared to $108 billion, it's really, it's a very smart investment in order to protect that $108 billion worth of spending and keep it coming here versus everywhere else it could go.
We'll be watching the legislative session, the special session, closely. In the meantime, we thank you for getting on the phone with us. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Hey, Melissa, I appreciate you and what you're doing, and really just proud to be part of your program. Thank you.
Thank you. He's Robert Scrobe, the executive director of the Florida Association of Destination Marketing Organizations. Much more still ahead later. The future of corneal transplants from local eye surgeon Dr. Arun Gulani. But up next, what's in store for America when it comes to the use of drones? Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Next time on 1A, we shine a light on solar power. A new report shows solar jobs jumped 25% from 2015 to last year. That is 17 times faster than the U.S. economy overall. The U.S. is out of the Paris Agreement, so what are the opportunities and limits on a solar future? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion on June 29th. To send your questions or to RSVP, go to wjct.org/events.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Welcome back. Well, as of January of this year, more than 600,000 people had registered their drones with the Federal Aviation Administration. Last year, the FAA put rules into place regarding the registration and use of these unmanned vehicles, which have an incredible variety of applications. Now, the regulations say that, among other things, people cannot operate drones carelessly or recklessly or fly above areas with crowds of people. Drones have amazing potential benefits for both recreational and business use. But as they become ever more common, what are the challenges and concerns? Issues with safety and privacy. In recent months, drones flying near airports have caused safety concerns. Speaking of which, just this week, the president announced plans to privatize the U.S. air traffic control system. That could take the responsibility away from the FAA, the agency that manages all U.S. air traffic control. And privatizing this would affect how drones fit safely into our national airspace. Lots to discuss here. Jamison Rice is an associate with the legal firm Holland & Knight, and he's an expert on how the future use of drones is going to probably play out, and he's on the line. Hey, Jamison, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa. I've listened to the show many times, and it's a privilege to be with you.
You too. And here's a question for our callers. What are your questions and concerns about the rapidly exploding use of unmanned vehicles known as drones, whether it's for fun, business use, even news gathering? 549-2937 to join us. They're even used by farmers. Jamison Rice, there are a lot of benefits to drones. Let's lead with that. Let's lead with the positive. Why drones are a technology that so many people are excited about?
Sure, yeah. Drones are coming. In fact, drones are here, and the technology that drones that possess far exceeds what's permissible at this point under federal law. They can fly autonomously. You can set where you'd like them to be operated. You can geofence them, which is to say you can set them to fly within a particular parameters. They can fly essentially autonomously. They could evade manned aircraft. All these things are capable, but not yet permitted. And they have tremendous commercial benefits. You could use them for news gathering. I mean, in Florida, absolutely, for covering fires or hurricanes, hovering over a house, traffic, all sorts of news gathering purposes, inspecting track, anywhere you'd want to get up where it would be dangerous to have somebody inspect or underneath a bridge. They're coming. They're here. And it's just a question of how you work out the details. How will they be regulated? How do you protect privacy while allowing this booming business? I just want to key on one thing. You mentioned the over 600,000 unmanned registered aircraft. And just for purposes of comparison, there's 200,000 registered manned aircraft. So that's, you know, more than three times as many registered unmanned aircraft. And registration has only been required or was required for the last 18 months.
Wow.
The FAA says there'll be more. FAA says there'll be more than 4 million by 2020. So it's the exception that's swallowing the rule for the FAA. Unmanned aircraft will vastly exceed the number of manned aircraft.
549-2937 as we talk about drones right now. So how is the regulatory framework set up right now, Jameson, and how do you anticipate it changing, particularly if we see some privatization of air traffic control? That would affect how drones operate.
It certainly would. It would be interesting to see how it plays out. How does a private operation, how does private control, as they have in Canada, how does that affect safety, which is the FAA's number one priority, and it should be. Potentially, there would be more ability to control such a vast operation with this many unmanned vehicles, but it remains to be seen. It's certainly an open question. There's no good answer there. I do want to say, though, that unmanned aircraft are really broken into two broad categories, and that is this commercial use that's only recently been allowed for about the last year, and then there's the model use, hobby, recreational use. That's the sort of thing, you know, you unwrap a Christmas gift and you've got a drone and you want to go fly it. And the FAA views those two things differently.
And so, under Florida law, for example, our property is protected from drone-captured images. The privacy concerns, I think, are really interesting for of concern for a lot of people. How do you see the battle over privacy playing out when it comes to how drones are used? Some people are afraid that they might be spied on by drone technology, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? This is not a new fear. The privacy laws in this country really started around 1900, and it just so happens that coincides with the first Kodak Brownie camera. Around that same time, it was the first time that cameras became commercially available. You could get one for a dollar. Obviously, the buying power of a dollar is a little different in 1900, but still, it was cheap. And people were worried that they could have their image captured anywhere because the people had cameras. It seems like a quaint concept, but it really caused quite a stir, almost a hysteria, over privacy rights. And the privacy laws that were created then continue to exist today, and they apply to each technology. They apply to cameras. They apply to phone surveillance and wiretapping, to telephoto lenses, to aerial image capture. There are privacy laws that prevent interference with your reasonable expectation of privacy, and they apply just as much to drones as they do to any of those other technologies. Now, there is a push to increase these privacy protections, and I think there's a reasonable question as to where you reasonably have an expectation of privacy. And drones raise really interesting questions about where it is that you have an expectation of privacy when it's easier to see you from different places. But the laws that already exist today protect your privacy rights just as they have for more than 100 years.
It's fascinating, though, to see how this technology is racing ahead of our current legal framework and safety framework, it seems, in some ways.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that in conversations with the FAA, they're very aware that they're going slowly and hesitantly. I mean, right now, the only way to operate a drone legally is to do it within your own line of sight, limited altitudes under 400 feet. You can't operate them at night unless you get a waiver. There's lots of restrictions that the drones themselves, the technology is capable of so much more. But until we get to that point, the FAA is releasing their regulations slowly, one at a time, bit by bit, to make sure that they have an understanding of the safety framework. And so, you know, there's a lot of push by industry to try to move these regulations along, and the FAA would certainly like to. They almost released a rule that would allow, for example, you're not allowed to fly over people. It's not permitted. However, they almost released a rule. They were just about to announce it and withheld it at the last minute that would allow flight over people. So, I mean, these are incremental steps that will happen bit by bit. once the safety case can be made. And the FAA is moving slower than business might like, but they're certainly aware of where the end game is. They're just not there yet.
All right, let's go to your calls now for Attorney Jameson Rice of Holland and Knight. We're talking about drones on the show, 549-2937. Sean along Atlantic Boulevard. Hey, Sean, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I'm glad to be on.
Sure.
So I'm also at Atlantic. I'm the lead engineer at Built Drones, and we have a lot of Part 101, Part 107 coming in all the time, always asking questions about the FAA regulation. Given that, we want to know, like, what's sort of, like, the step-by-step that you would think that would be good to get a point of contact, or who should you contact for these hobbyists or consumers in guys that want to stay aligned with the FAA regulations so they won't have to overcross these boundaries, have the breakthrough rules and regulations that they know and they abide with and be aware with. So that's my question.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sean. Jameson.
Sure. Well, the FAA, since they've, again, let's be clear on the difference between model drone use and commercial use. For commercial use, you actually have to get a license from the FAA. You have to sit for a test, and you have to abide by the other regulations. Model use, there's certain stipulations as well. It's not as restrictive. But for model use, there was just a recent court decision, a federal appeals court decision, that stopped the prohibition, that stopped the requirement to register drones. So back in, just as a little bit of history, back in just before Christmas in 2015, the FAA said anybody that gets a drone just for hobby use that gets one as a Christmas present, they need to register that drone, pay $5, give personal information, and register that drone. A federal appeals court said that that exceeded congressional authority, and they struck down the law. So model drones really are regulated less. Now, there are still requirements. You still can't fly them over people. You still can't fly them at light night unless they're illuminated. You have to contact an airport, the air traffic control, if you're going to fly them within 3 miles. So there are restrictions. They're common sense safety restrictions. You don't want to fly them over people in case something would happen to it and it would fall. You don't want to fly them near an airport because you don't want to interfere with aircraft. You don't want to fly them at night because you can't see what you might run into, and others can't see it either. But if you're operating them for just because you have one personally and you're not doing this as part of a business, then the FAA's website is a great resource to tell you what you can and can't do. They're mostly common sense restrictions, but there are restrictions. You can't just do whatever you like with them because you could find yourself in trouble.
Sure. In the meantime, there was a drone conference just last week in North Dakota, I think. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao spoke at this event, and she talked about starting a pilot program to let local communities experiment with different ways of controlling drone activity in their cities. This could open the door, Jameson, for private companies to track drone flights, get government contracts to provide those services instead of the FAA. There are a lot of tentacles to this.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, this is an interesting fight that's playing out in many different ways. Believe it or not, it is an open question as to whether where your property rights as an owner extend. The FAA takes the position that they can regulate from the top of a blade of grass all the way up as far as you can go. State and local laws, you may have seen various city ordinances that have passed that are trying to regulate where you can operate drones. And the state has weighed in as well. In fact, there's pending legislation proposed by the federal government that would allow state and local authority to regulate drones under 200 feet, but would take everything above 200 feet. And it hasn't yet been signed by the governor, but Florida legislature just passed a law that would prevent local, so state and local, cities and local ordinances from prescribing operation of drones. So the problem is the cities are trying to react to real problems, and it's not yet clear where their rights end and where FAA authority begins. And then you add the state level, and you've got a hodgepodge of laws across the country, and it's not yet clear where the line is. And that's going to be playing itself out over the next several years. What we really need is clear. clarity and guidance so that everyone can play by the same rules. Business owners are not going to be able to come up with a business model if they have to change that from city to city. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out.
It sure will. I think we'll be watching as well to see when more widespread drone delivery, for example, gets really going in this country. It's a really interesting topic. And Jameson, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Attorney Jameson Rice, he's an associate with the firm Holland & Knight. And we'll be right back.
Passing a tax cut is only the first step.
If you're trying to make larger structural changes to the tax system that you think would be good, that's going to take a lot longer to deliver the promised benefits.
I'm Adrienne Hill. Taxes and the economy, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Save the date for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, August 26, 2017 at the Hyatt Riverfront. Join us for a day of pampering and making time to care for you. Be inspired by health experts, free screenings, and great door prizes. Keynote speaker is Jennifer Berman, MD, co-host of the Emmy Award-winning talk show, The Doctors. Go to wjct.org/girlsdayout to register.
Welcome back. Well, we often think of St. Augustine as having a connection to pirates and adventurers, and some of those tales are actually real life. Back in 1979, British adventurer Tristan MacDonald, his wife, Alex, and their two teenage kids sold their house and business and everything they owned. They left behind their coastal hometown of Penzance in England. Remember the Pirates of Penzance? And they headed for the U.S. on their 45-foot yacht. Once they got here, they stopped in the nation's oldest city, and they decided to start their own restaurant, the Rain Tree. They did this with absolutely no restaurant experience. But nearly 40 years later, the Rain Tree is still family-owned and operated by the McDonald's. In today's Movable Feast, our new segment looking at dining destinations all around the town, Lee Cord of the Women's Food Alliance speaks with Lorna McDonald on her family's incredible journey.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. You with the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's Cacciatore, Dore.
Good morning, Lorna McDonald. I'm so glad you're here from St. Augustine and the Rain Tree Restaurant, actually one of my favorite for about 20 years. I'm so amazed at your family's saga about coming to St. Augustine and beginning the restaurant, and it's not 1790.
No, we actually came over in 79 and opened in 81. So we've actually been open 36 years this August.
How old were you when the family sailed? And would you share with our listeners a little bit of the story about where you came from and how you landed in St. Augustine?
Well, I'm an original pirate. I was born in Penzance in Cornwall, where the pirates were from. Then we sailed over here on our boat in 79. We spent 2 years traveling with my mom, my dad, and my brother on a 45-foot yacht. And we sailed across the Atlantic. That passage took us about just under 18 days.
Oh, my.
And very adventurous. We had a very fast crossing. It was very exciting. We all loved to sail, so that made it even more fun. And we eventually we left Tenerife and the Canary Islands and arrived in Barbados, Bridgetown. Then that was the main crossing, and then we went down into the Grenadines and then the Caribbean and then back up through the Bahamas and across to the U.S. So that's how we got here.
Did they plan to end in St. Augustine and land here?
No. Our original plan was to go to the Chesapeake Bay area. That was sort of the the intent, but my brother actually got off the boat. He met a girl in Palm Beach, so he left. And then I met the dock master at St. Augustine Marina, so I'm like, okay, well, I think I want to stay here. And next thing I know, we ended up going to the Raintree. Well, it was then, it was the Casa de España, a little Spanish restaurant, for my birthday, which would have been my 19th birthday.
Oh, my.
And we all went there for dinner. And when we, it was run by this little lady, and she had like four kids and she'd just gotten divorced. And when we ordered our dinner, she actually went to the Winn-Dixie on her bike to buy the food. So it was kind of, we spent a very long time waiting for our dinner. So we had lots of wine and a good time, and then decided that it would make a really nice restaurant if somebody, you know, took it over and did something with it. So,
well, listening to the story about your brother and you and the two of you finding romance at your in your young ages, now I understand more about the romantic nature of Raintree. It is a very romantic, lovely restaurant.
It is. It is. It's definitely held that through all the years. It's like, you know, lots of, you know, engagements and weddings and rehearsals and family memories. It's like, you know, it's like we've been there so long now, even down to our staff. I mean, we hired the parents, now we're hiring the children of the original staff, and it's just, you know, how it just keeps evolving. So the whole family romance and, you know, it's a, St. Augustine's such an amazing town. I can't imagine having stopped in that community to think that I would have ever gone anywhere else. It's just, I'll never move.
Well, it's such
St.
a beautiful landmark also. You're on San Marco, and you see this beautiful white, describe the building for our listeners.
Well, it's a Victorian era. We've done a lot to the building. It's yellow and got very traditional. Well, we have a nice courtyard now, which we didn't have when we opened originally. It was a lot of greenery and, you know, kind of hidden. Now we have a large courtyard area, which is great outdoor dining. So we see probably 50 people outside, and there's lots of red and white awnings, and it's just really pretty. Lots of weddings.
But it feels so romantic. This, it's fenced in and it's grand, and it doesn't look like anything else in St. Augustine. It's beautiful.
No, well, you know, when you have, we have lots of different rooms too, so it makes everything a little more individual. I mean, there's sometimes when you have large parties where it'd be nice to have one big giant room, but we can't offer that. Ours is much more intimate, which I guess brings on the romance.
Who has evolved today, head of your culinary team, your executive chef?
Well, I've got a combination. My husband is a chef and also a general contractor. Very important when you have something like the Raintree, because we have this old house and we also have the, you know, the everyday-to-day cooking. I also have Jeff Keane, who's been with us for, goodness, probably 18 or 19 years. And then Matt Berg, who has been a longtime friend of mine, and I'd say he's been with us about 10 years. So, got a great, great team. I mean, they all do a fabulous job.
And when did my favorite dish, oh my gosh, the beef Wellington. I mean, I can't go there without ordering it. I mean, I don't think I've had many other things on the menu. I love the beef Wellington, and not many restaurants serve that. So when did that evolve on the menu? That's one of your signatures.
Day one. Always had it. It's, we've never not had it on our menu. That and our brandy pepper steak are the two items that have never left. It's like, you know, others have come and go, but those two are, they just stay there.
It's just delicious. I wish I could describe it in words for our listeners. They're just going to have to go themselves. I know another one of my favorite times there is late night. I love to sit outside or even in your lovely little romantic bar and have late night dessert.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's always the Bananas Foster. Talk about late-night dessert and what it means in St. Augustine.
Well, dessert in general is always worth talking about. We have crepes, which are, like you said, the banana crepe, and also mixed berries. We have, you know, key lime pie, creme brulee. We have all kinds of great desserts, everything homemade. And it's just a place that, you know, if you want to come and have a nice cappuccino and a dessert after dinner somewhere else, you're always welcome to come to the Raintree. Or you can just have one after dinner when you've had your beef Wellington, you know.
And when guests come to the Raintree, what members of the family do they see?
Well, I'd love to say I'm always there, but I'm not. Times have changed. My son is one of the managers there, Zach. So he's he's there 5 nights a week. And then I consider the other manager, Ersh, also to be my son, even though he's Hungarian, but he's been there a long time. So it's like they're my two main men, and they take care of the front of the house while we have Jeff and Matt in the back of the house. And Chris and I are just pretty much always there on the weekends. And then we're in and out all day during the week, but you know, not necessarily there all evening.
Well, I have a taste for Bananas Foster right now. So what do you see the next year coming? What new things are on the horizon, maybe for you, or the street, or the beautiful house, or menu, or business at the Rain Tree?
Well, we're always looking to grow, that's for sure. It's like St. Augustine is on the map. It certainly doesn't seem like anything's slowing down. Always the big one for us is the Night of Lights. It's like that just sets St. Augustine off, and that starts the Saturday prior to Thanksgiving and runs through the end of January. And that is just the biggest coup for St. Augustine and for us. It's like we deck out, we light up the restaurant and inside and out. And even though we're not on the path of the tour trains, they do a competition every year, and we placed third last year. For considering we're not even on the tour, I think that's pretty impressive that we got third place. So I was pleased with that.
It's such a beautiful landmark. Yeah. Well, thank you. I think I'll probably see you next time sitting on the patio with a Cavassier and a little Bananas Foster and some good friends.
A woman after my own heart. Oh,
thank you. Thank you, Lorna McDonald.
Thank you.
All right, and finally this hour, more than 40,000 corneal transplants are performed in the U.S. and many multitudes more around the world. The concept is to replace a blinding or damaged cornea of the patient's eye with a donor cornea. This can involve invasive surgery and a long rehab. But here's an idea. Is eye donation like this a thing of the past? Recent advances are showing most patients can actually regenerate the living layer of their cornea and heal themselves. World-renowned eye surgeon and surgical innovator Dr. Arun Gulani here in Jacksonville has actually performed this technique on a local patient, and he recovered his vision without a transplant. This patient is the first in the world. Dr. Gulani just shared this story with eye surgeons from around the globe at the National Academy of Eye Surgeon Conference, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. This is exciting stuff. So you have a local patient, and you performed a technique on him where he actually was able to heal himself, the first in the world. How did this come about?
So corneal transplants has been around for centuries, actually, and it's the reason, most common reason we use the eye from a donation to help somebody who's blind. But if you look at the main cause for blindness in these cases, it's corneal scars. And the majority of causes for corneal scars are simple things like contact lens infections, LASIK complications, and things like that. And doing a transplant, I'm a transplant surgeon, is much more invasive and does affect these patients' lifestyle adversely. Mm-hmm. So I've been constantly honing over the last two decades my LASIK techniques to a point now where you can use the same laser as in LASIK and reverse these scars to 20/20 and give these patients their lives back. The other common indication for corneal transplants is the condition we call Fuchs dystrophy of the cornea, which is when the cornea living cells start dying. This is a genetic disease, and the cornea loses clarity. Here, too, we've been doing a very special layered transplant, just a layer, without stitches, just an air bubble. But recently, I was in Japan 2 years ago teaching at the World Conference when I spoke to some scientists there, and they have done research on the stem cells of the patient's own eyes. So I used that concept, and our own patients here, in fact, two of them locally 3 months ago, and they're both doing excellent with clear cornea without transplants.
This is amazing. So how did you hit upon this technique?
As you know, Melissa, my desire is always, how can I raise the bar in vision for every patient I come across? So last week we had patients from, I think, 7 different countries, 4 states, and so many local patients we worked on. Many of their scars were, again, from LASIK complications, contact lens infections, mild trauma. When you look at the cases, you go, these patients actually were 20/20 to begin with. So you look at the desperation in these cases, and you look at that you can impact their life either way. Better or worse, why not make it better with the least interventional, most elegant technique? And therewith, just like in the LASIK techniques that I've been improvising for 20 years now, take vision beyond 2020, if we can.
And do you see this new technique having lots more applications than with this first patient you've successfully used it on?
Absolutely. If you look at patients who are told they're not LASIK candidates because of these conditions, because corneal scars can not only cause poor vision, it can also induce high astigmatism. And then these patients have to wear glasses, contacts for the rest of their lives. With this new laser technique now, all the patients who are told they're not LASIK candidates can be corrected to perfect vision. Mm-hmm. Also, if these patients are going at a cataract age, it's important that these associated conditions be corrected by the laser so they have a great cataract surgery outcome too. So the implications are tremendous and unmeasurable.
And you presented this just last week at the National Academy of Eye Surgeons Conference. What was the reaction?
A lot of colleagues that I interacted with in Los Angeles a few weeks ago at our national conference, and then a month from now, I'll be teaching in Europe and Asia Pacific these concepts. I think it's very exciting. It's the future direction. Doctors and surgeons are very excited because everybody wants to help their patients with the least intervention.
And you're based here in Jacksonville, but these are techniques you're trying to export around the world. Pretty cool stuff.
It's a privilege to be here, Melissa. Absolutely.
He is eye surgeon and surgical innovator, Dr. Arun Gulani of Jacksonville. And now you're off on another trip, correct?
Yes, in a month. But again, I love it when surgeons already are landing here today itself to see these techniques, and it's more than a pleasure to share.
Well, keep us posted. And we all need our precious sight, don't we? So thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Melissa, again for having me.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime or on iTunes. Next on 1A, solar's future is bright, but clouds are in the forecast. That's ahead. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.